Hello, and welcome to Distillations, weekly extracts from the past, present, and future of chemistry. I'm Robert Hicks. Each week, we bring you stories on all things chemical, from manganese to motherboards. In this week's show, we'll visit Silicon Valley, where CHF hosted a joint symposium with the Semiconductor Trade Association, SEMI, last week. We'll speak with one of the pioneers of the semiconductor equipment industry and take a behind-the-scenes tour of the Computer History Museum. That's all coming up on today's episode of Distillations. Silicon Valley is without a doubt the center of the world's semiconductor industry. But how did this small tract along the Northern California coast reach such elite status? The celebrated heroes of these early success stories are associated with companies that make microchips, the Intels and the AMDs. There were, however, a number of lesser-known yet key players in the Silicon Revolution. They were the companies that supplied the chip makers with various manufacturing equipment and materials. As chip manufacturing became increasingly complex, it required a collective effort from a broad range of expertise, including optics, chemistry, and even nuclear physics. This dynamic industry will be the focus of today's show. First up, the element without which none of this technology would be possible. CHF's Audra Wolf has more.
Silicon is the second most abundant element on Earth, bested only by oxygen. It makes up nearly a quarter of the Earth's crust. Although widely known for its use in the semiconductor industry, the largest use of silicon is actually in automobile manufacturing. Silicon aluminum alloys, which typically contain around 20% silicon, are used to cast engine parts. Silicon is also widely used to make silicone, used for caulking materials, breast implants, and heat-resistant potholders. In natural form, silicon easily combines with oxygen to form silicon dioxide, something we typically see as sand or quartz. To be used in the semiconductor industry, silicon has to be purified, made into a single crystal ingot, sliced into silicon wafers, and then diced into silicon chips. When these chips are exposed to air, a thin layer of silicon dioxide coats the surface, creating an insulating layer that protects the intricate structure within the solid-state crystal. Fairchild Semiconductor took advantage of this so-called planar process in the late 1950s, and is now a standard manufacturing process for virtually every integrated circuit we use in our daily lives. And that's it for today's Element of the Week. I'm Audra Wolf.
Next up, CHF's Young Sub Choi spoke with Griff Resor, a longtime leader in the semiconductor industry and a speaker at the recent SEMI Symposium.
Thanks for joining us, Mr. Resor.
Oh, it's my pleasure.
So why do you think that the semiconductor equipment and materials sector emerged when it did in the mid to late 1960s?
Well, I was impressed today to see that the very early people had a lot of trouble with materials purity, and they had to build all the machinery in-house. And I learned, at least here in Silicon Valley, some of those inside machinery groups then spun out, raised risk capital, and started some machinery businesses. That doesn't account for all of the people that emerged, but it's clear that everybody started building, taking standard laboratory tools and then modifying them, and then decided that they didn't want to be building machinery, they needed to be building chips and serving chip companies.
So overall, what is your view on the contributions that the semiconductor equipment and materials industry made in the ongoing Silicon Revolution that we see today?
Well, I think it's in several phases. Once they got out of the chip-making companies, the first thing they did, the equipment companies did, was just made equipment available. And then the next phase, I saw myself, is as we built equipment for multiple customers, very quickly we learned, by having all those different test cases, different customers, we learned how to build better equipment. And we were also committed to supporting it with service and later applications know-how. And the inside teams had no interest in maintaining the tools. And because they only served one internal customer, they generally didn't have as good as robust a design. So I think that's what the equipment industry added early on. And then today we've heard that as the industry's matured, more and more of the process knowledge and the process development has fallen onto the equipment companies.
So do you think there was a fundamentally different dynamics between equipment and material sector?
In the equipment business, when you have a down year, you lose a lot of money. So you have to save money in the up cycle to just survive the down cycle. And it means you can't spend it on R&D, you can't spend it on building better customer support. And I think throughout the day, we heard again, a lot of people feel this challenge of how do you fund the innovation that allows you to stay alive as an equipment company.
So what, in your view, are the main challenges facing the industry today and perhaps tomorrow?
Well, clearly we heard that the equipment companies are challenged to raise enough money to fund R&D and innovation. That's always been true. And we heard the top 5 or 10 equipment companies probably will prevail, in that there's some innovation companies and there's commercialization companies. I thought those were all interesting observations today. Jerry Cooter brought up another problem for the materials companies, and that's that these markets are still pretty small compared to the chemicals that go into, for example, making rugs. You can sell it by the tank car, and this has always been by the kilo or liter.
Well, thank you very much for joining us, Mr. Rizor.
Well, thank you for having me.
Youngsub Choi is Senior Manager for Electronics, Innovation, and Emerging Technology Programs at the Center for Contemporary History and Policy. He spoke with Griff Rizor, former Chief Technology Officer of GCA and current President of Rizor Associates. You're listening to Distillations. I'm Robert Hicks. Finally today, we'll take a behind-the-scenes tour of the Computer History Museum, the site of the semi-symposium. Mia Lobel has more.
My name is Bill, and I worked for IBM for 19 years, and I'm an O guy, so I worked on a lot of the computers that are here, the old ones, the mainframe, so it's kind of like old home week.
Bill is visiting the Computer History Museum's visible storage collection in Mountain View, California, with his two sons, Jim and Eric, both software engineers. The first thing you see when you walk into the warehouse-sized collection room is the wall of PCs, a floor-to-ceiling display of personal computers dating from the early 70s to the late 90s. Senior curator Dag Spicer says you can usually tell how old a visitor is by what they're drawn to on this wall.
These are the computers that most people alive today are familiar with. So that's to kind of let people connect right away with something, as you did. They go, oh, yes, I used the Apple II or the Commodore.
Spicer admits that nostalgia is a big part of this museum, but it's also a record of computing history for the past 500 years. Founded in 1979, the museum is now home to the largest collection of computing artifacts in the world.
We're trying to preserve this stuff right now before it's too late, because people do not appreciate the fact that they're living in history while it's happening.
The oldest object in the museum is a set of ivory calculating tools from the 1650s called Napier's Bones. The newest item is an original iPod prototype. The heart of the collection, however, is a series of computers from the mid-40s to the mid-70s, showing the dynamic effect of Moore's Law on computer size and power. In essence, Moore's Law says computing will get exponentially smaller, faster, and cheaper over time. We begin in 1946 with the Electronic Numerical Integrator and Computer, commonly known as ENIAC.
So what you're looking at is a rack. It's painted in a black World War II crinkle finish. It's about 8 feet high. This one rack alone has maybe 1,000 vacuum tubes, maybe a little more.
The entire ENIAC system used about 18,000 vacuum tubes on 40 panels. It was first designed to create firing tables to help World War II gunners control their howitzers. Before ENIAC, it would take a team of programmers a month to produce one table. ENIAC allowed them to do it in 20 minutes. But the system took 130,000 watts of power, enough for 30 or 40 homes, and it could never be shut off. It took engineers only 10 years to solve the size and energy problem of the ENIAC, and by 1955, computer scientists made the leap from vacuum tubes to transistors.
If you compare a transistor to a vacuum tube is almost like the size of a light bulb, and a transistor is probably the size of a pencil eraser in comparison. They do equivalent things. The difference is the vacuum tube needs a constant voltage to heat it up. Transistor doesn't have to boil electrons off a little piece of metal, and switches a lot faster, much cheaper and simpler to manufacture, and more reliable.
Transistors were soon used in everything from radios and televisions to the Apollo guidance computer, which is housed at the museum. It was only a few more years before engineers learned to cram millions of transistors onto wafers of silicon to create integrated circuits, the model for the microprocessors in the modern PCs we have today. Dag Spicer and his team found a creative way to demonstrate this dramatic progress.
What we did last year is we took a Trio, which is a smartphone, and we said, what if you took this Trio and built it out of vacuum tubes? So it turned out we would need an area of about 10 square miles, because a Trio has millions of transistors in it. And we needed a nuclear power plant, because it was the only one who could produce 3 million watts of power. Of course, it's not portable anymore, so that's kind of a drag.
He says this progress is the difference between what's possible and impossible in the future of computing technology. Not many history museums pride themselves on a collection that focuses mainly on only 40 years of work, but for the Computer History Museum, the rules aren't quite the same. Ancient history happens within one lifetime, and the unimaginable future is only a few years away. For Distillations, I'm Mia Lobel.
And that's it for this week's episode of Distillations. For more information and links to past shows, please visit our website at distillations.chemheritage.org. Today's quotation comes from Bell Labs chemist N. Bruce Hannay from a 1962 speech. There are many examples of the values of interdisciplinary approach to be found in solid-state research. Thus, the detailed understanding of the basic physics of semiconductors could not have been achieved without the cooperative efforts of chemists and metallurgists who provided control over both the purity and crystalline perfection of the materials. Distillations is a presentation of the Chemical Heritage Foundation and is made possible by the generous support of the Richard Lounsbery Foundation. Mia Lobel is our senior producer. Our assistant producer is Victoria Indeviro. And our executive producer is Audra Wolf. Our theme music is composed and performed by Dave Kaufman. Additional music provided from the PodSafe Music Network. Check it out at music.podshow.com. Please tell us what you think about our program and send suggestions for future shows to distillations@chemheritage.org. Until next time, I'm Robert Hicks.